And with that, I would like to welcome Cyrus.
Yes, hi, hello.
Hi. Could you maybe start with a little background of the historical background of basically Iranian nuclear program, how it started? As my understanding is that it goes about 30, 35 years ago, early 70s, and during the Shah's era, and somehow U.S. Department of Energy was also involved in designing the master plan for Iranian nuclear initiative. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, actually, Iran's nuclear program really goes back quite farther than that. It goes back to the 1950s in the Eisenhower era. However, it was in the 1970s that Iran began in earnest in developing nuclear energy alternatives, or considering the development of nuclear energy alternatives. Under the Shah, the plan was to build, I think it was at the time, 20 nuclear reactors, and that was when the Shah started investing heavily in transactions with the Germany, the United States, and France in the purchase of nuclear reactors and in sending his students from Iran to the places like MIT to study nuclear engineering.
And what was the justification at that time, and how come today U.S. is so concerned about such a ambitious program in the Middle East or in Iran, considering that Iran is also the second exporter of OPEC and the fourth producer of oil in the world?
Well, at the time, the Shah was concerned about the eventual running out of oil of Iran, for one thing, and also because he didn't want, he believed that the oil was too precious to simply burn to power automobiles inside Iran. It was much better for Iran to be able to export this material as a value-added product to earn income. As most people know, oil is Iran's major and probably only real export, and its only source of income, its only source of foreign currency. At the time, in the 1970s, there was the Stanford Research Institute, which conducted a study which concluded that Iran had a very legitimate case for diversifying its energy resources. This was something that it had to do because the oil was not going to last forever. It's a finite resource, and Iran needed to export the oil in order to earn income. And as we've seen since then, Iran's population has simply increased, and its oil consumption domestically has increased, and there is and it's meanwhile its oil fields have aged, and the oil production has decreased. So the Iranians were, at that time, looking forward and into considering what's going to happen to Iran after the oil. And today, of course, we are told by many specialists and economists that we've reached the point of peak oil production. And so even today, and meanwhile, Iran's population has significantly increased, and so has its oil consumption and its energy demand domestically as well as internationally. The energy demand has gone up. So it's only more important for Iran today to develop alternative sources of energy.
Let's maybe discuss the NPT and the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. What are the legal basis of NPT, and what are the commitments of member states? We know that there are major players in the role in this game that are not member of NPT, such as Israel and Pakistan and North Korea, but Iran is a member to NPT. What commitment members do give, and what do they expect from the other members of the treaty?
Well, basically, after the United States and the Soviet Union developed nuclear weapons, a number of other countries started developing nuclear weapons, and over time, it became obvious that this gradual worldwide development of nuclear weapons was a threat to all humanity, which had to stop. And so countries got together and signed what was known as the Non-Proliferation Treaty, also known as the NPT. A number of countries did not sign this treaty. These were Israel, Pakistan, India, Currently, there are some other countries that hadn't signed it but signed it later on, but these are the countries currently which are not signatories. And they did develop nuclear weapons on, without any restriction by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. However, the countries that did sign it were essentially found to two groups. These were the nuclear-armed countries. These were the five nuclear-armed countries of France, Britain, the United States, China, and the Soviet Union. And then there were everyone else who didn't have nuclear weapons who also signed on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And this was essentially a bargain. This was a two-way street. According to this bargain, both sides undertook some obligations. The non-nuclear countries, meaning everyone else, other than the original five nuclear powers, they agreed to not develop nuclear weapons in exchange and to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect their nuclear facilities and to report their nuclear activities in exchange for certain promises from the countries that did have nuclear weapons, and including the United States. And there are basically three obligations imposed by the Non-Proliferation Treaty on the nuclear-armed states. First is that they should work towards disarmament of their own nuclear stockpiles. Second was that they would share nuclear technology, civilian nuclear technology, with the other countries who had signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the third would be that they would not share nuclear technology with which countries that had not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, of course, in practice, even, you know, there was a lot of argument that this, in effect, created an apartheid system of countries, some countries which were legitimized as nuclear powers and some countries which were outsiders and would never be able to develop nuclear technology because the nuclear technology would be monopolized by those original five countries. And essentially today what we're seeing is the original five countries expanding their ambitions under the NPT without regard to their obligations. That's the accusation.
And I mean that we now know the fact that that some of the the countries who already had nuclear power, especially the military part of it, have shared their technology and their capabilities with other countries, such as Great Britain and United States with Israel, and then other countries with India and Pakistan, and still continue. And this is actually a very interesting case that you mentioned. India is not part of NPT. But Bush's administration is now negotiating export of nuclear technology to India.
Yeah, it's one of the many ironies of the Bush administration that the Bush administration has essentially bribed the Indians and convinced them to vote against Iran in the IAEA by promising them to provide them with nuclear technology, which would be a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So on one hand, Iran is being pressured to abide by more than what it is required to abide by under the Non-Proliferation Treaty through a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it just really goes to show the extent to which the double standard, which everyone concedes is there, and no one can really deny that this double standard has just simply gone beyond any bounds of sanity, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Let's continue our introduction to the topic. Could you just give a summary of then the Iranian were been started the negotiation with the three European Union members, Germany, France, and UK, and how did that negotiation go in the past 2-3 years?
Well, the negotiations essentially culminated in what was known as the Paris Agreement. This was an agreement that Iran signed with the three countries which are known as the EU three, even though at the time they did not officially have any kind of EU backing, European Union backing, but they're referred to as the EU three. And according to the Paris Agreement, the specific terms of the Paris Agreement, which anyone can look up on the internet, the EU3 agreed to respect Iran's rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to possess civilian nuclear technology. This is specifically enshrined in Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they agreed to this. They put their signature onto this agreement. And they, in fact, they were widely criticized in the U.S. for doing so. However, in the course of the negotiations with the EU3, even though Iran had agreed to suspend uranium enrichment, even though it was under no obligation to do so, but did so as a voluntary measure, in the course of the negotiations, the EU3, it became obvious that they were not going to live up to this agreement. They demanded that Iran make its enrichment permanent, even though it was never any obligation to do so, and the Paris Agreement specifically said so. And they also continued to try to drag out the negotiations as long as possible in order to prevent Iran's restarting of its enrichment process. And they tried to drag this on for about as long as they could until Iran finally had to put its foot down and demanded that they make their final offer, whatever, you know, to put an end to the negotiations one way or the other, at which point they came back with an offer, which other analysts have referred to as an empty box of chocolates. It was essentially a meaningless offer, which was a violation of the terms of the Paris Agreement, and it was obviously going to be rejected by Iran. And Iran naturally rejected this offer, at which time the EU3 promptly accused Iran of violating the Paris Agreement.
And that brings us to close to where we are right now, a change in the government in Iran happened last summer, and the new negotiators were dispatched, and as we know, the negotiation later on get to a point that the Board of Governors decided to report Iran to Security Council of United Nations. Before we go there, let's have a short music break, and we'll be back and continue our dialogue with Cyrus Haftari, who is a political analyst, and I'm talking to him from New York.
از دروغات خسته شدم. جدایی تو گوش گیر زندو مرخص زیر بارو من خنده یه بهارم تو قربت زمستون
Welcome back. You're listening to Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudar Zaktadari, your host, and my guest is Cyrus Safdari. I'm talking to him from New York, and we are discussing about the nuclear programs of Iranian government and the referral from IAEA's Board of Governors to United Nations Security Council. What is not being reported in fact, is that Iranian government came to the three EU members at the end of January and offered a six-point proposal that kind of either was rejected or was not even mentioned in anywhere in discussions. Cyrus, could you talk to these 6 points and tell us whether there was anything new or it was nothing of significant.
Well, this wasn't. First of all, this wasn't the first time that Iran's offers of compromise were simply dismissed and not even mentioned in any detail in the Western media, which is sort of ironic. And I think we should get into that some more. Over the course of negotiations with the EU, Iran had made several offers of compromise, and these would have addressed any legitimate fear of nuclear proliferation or weapons manufacturing. But these were simply dismissed. They weren't even considered. And right before the Iran's file went to was reported to the Security Council by the IAEA, as you said, in January, Iran offered to continue the suspension of enrichment for an additional 2 years. Now, this is pretty much as shocking an offer as you can expect, because here was Iran offering to even continue the suspension, and this was almost entirely not mentioned in the Western media. It was it was in an article in Asia Times that a particular analyst brought it up. And it had been reported in the Iranian press, but in the Western press, in the U.S. press especially, this was not even mentioned.
And what was those 6 points? Do you?
I don't remember all six of them. Specifically, though, and the Iran offered to pledge expanded cooperation with the inspectors and to never make nuclear weapons. Iran had made these offers before. The most important and Iran's offers at the time were simply dismissed, but the most important offer was the sixth one, which Iran added on to all of this right before it went to the IAEA, to the Security Council, in which Iran pledged to suspend enrichment for an additional 2 years as negotiations continued. So on one hand, we have the EU3 telling Iran to suspend enrichment, and on the other hand, Iran has agreed to suspend it for 2 years, but they don't even consider this offer.
But I guess the question is really whether there was a negotiation or not. And from what we hear is a unilateral discussion, and that's why whatever Iranian party offered would not have been considered in any ways, because I emphasize that in many of Bush administration policies in the Middle East, the term negotiation is being used, but it's actually unilateralism. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a definite pattern here. As I said, if it was an actual concern about the threat of nuclear weapons here, Iran had made some very good offers, offers which corresponded to suggestions by international authorities on resolving this issue. And these were simply dismissed offhand. One can't help but reach the conclusion, especially when Iran has agreed to suspend enrichment and for 2 years, and its offer was dismissed. One can't help but reach the conclusion that these negotiations were never really intended to reach a solution to begin with.
that the offer that or the proposal that Russia has, and I guess literally U.S. is supporting it, I don't know how far, but the option of taking uranium from Iran and enriching it in Russia and then bring it back to be used in a nuclear facility and then taking back the used fuel. How this thing was discussed, and do you have any detail about what the process was and what was they expecting Iranian party to do, and who would pay for these transportation and all the costs of this?
All the costs would be covered by Iran. This was the Russians viewed this as a very good money-making opportunity. They are currently, when it comes to Iran's light water reactor that they are completing in the city of Bushehr, they have already agreed with the Iranians that they will provide the fuel for that reactor, and they will take back its spent fuel and take care of it, thus completely removing any chance that it can be used for nuclear weapons. They wanted to do the same with the uranium enrichment program, which is a separate program from the nuclear reactor, which is being built in Bushehr. And both of these were going to be very financially beneficial to the Russians. However, they would not, no one considers these to be a real opportunity out of this impasse with the United States for a number of reasons. For one thing, just from a practicality point of view, it's highly impractical. No one has ever done anything like this before. The legalities of it are going to take years to negotiate. From a security point of view, from the point of view of Iran, this would mean that the Russians would have essentially a death grip on Iran's economic development, because they would have a grip on Iran's ability to run its economy and produce energy in the future. No country, of course, would voluntarily allow its energy resources to be held hostage by another country, especially when Iran has the legal right to do all of this in its own on its own soil.
And I guess especially with examining of Russia and how they treated Ukrainians just recently.
That's right. Both Ukraine and Georgia have seen how reliable the Russians can be in providing energy to them. The Russians cut them off because they wanted more money for the energy which they were providing those two countries. The message is, no one expects this to be a workable solution in reality, because also you have to remember, no one believes that if Iran accepts this proposal, that the conflict with the United States would end. The United States isn't going to say, okay, so they've done this, so now we're going to not say anything anymore about nuclear weapons. They're going to continue with the speculation about secret nuclear sites, for example, or what Iran intends to do with nuclear technology, or what it could do, and that sort of thing. Because ultimately, we have a lot of people in Washington, D.C., who are not so much concerned about nuclear weapons or nuclear technology, but about their fantasies about regime change in Iran. And that is really the motivating force behind this conflict, and the nuclear issue is merely a pretext.
And that actually brings a point that I wanted to ask. Well, obviously we know that this is a neocons agenda, and we are kind of in a baby steps of what ended with the Iraqi invasion 5 years ago, and we are now following exactly the same steps as it was the weapons of mass destruction, the terrorism, and so on and so forth. But how other European countries were brought in, how China was brought in, how Russia was brought in. China has a very extensive financial relation and economic relation with Iran, especially with energy and how they need Iranian oil and gas. And they have plans for future to use a pipeline through Kazakhstan to China from Iran. How did they come into this? Also, India has a negotiation right going on to purchase, I think, $5 billion of oil from Iran through Pakistan.
That's a very interesting question, because it was assumed that these countries would stand against the United States. And to a very large extent, during this process, they did refuse to go along with the agenda. However, India switched its positions when India was promised certain benefits from the United States, nuclear technology being one of them, improved economic relations with the United States, and making India into a competitor with China. That was the promise that was given to them. And so that explains their position. With the Russians and the Chinese, essentially these countries are minding their own store. They're minding their own interests. And no one knows exactly what went on in the negotiations between the United States, Britain, and those two countries, which convinced them to agree to the reporting of Iran's file to the UN Security Council. But it can be presumed that whatever bargaining went on, they were promised that their interests as far as access to oil would not be harmed, because essentially Iran has to sell its oil in order to earn an income anyway. So it may be that this theory that Iran is going to cut off the sales of oil was not considered to be a serious threat to them in the first place.
But I guess a part of the program for a Security Council action would be some sort of embargo on Iran, and if that embargo does not include oil purchase, what do you think would be in negotiation on United Nations Security Council meeting? I think it was scheduled for March, early March, to decide diplomacy they will continue. And George Bush keeps saying that diplomacy is still continuing, but within Security Council. But, I mean, what are the tools that Security Council may use in this regard?
I think we have to remember that there wasn't a worldwide embargo on the purchase of oil from Iraq either. However, that didn't stop the United States from pursuing its agenda. And in fact, during the Security Council, none of the members of the Security Council approved the invasion of Iraq. But that again didn't stop the United States from pursuing its agenda. So the suggestion that that China and Russia are going to veto resolutions and prevent the United States from carrying out its agenda, I think that's optimistic. I think the United States simply wants the matter to be in the Security Council, to have a veneer of legitimacy, and to take it out of the field of the IAEA, because the IAEA inspectors weren't finding the stuff that the United States was saying it was there. So they want to move it out of there and take it to the Security Council, where the United States can put its own spin on matters. And essentially, China and Russia may be under the impression that they can veto actions against Iran, but as we have seen, what they say doesn't really stop the United States, because they're not willing to back it up with force, and the United States is willing to resort to force. I suspect what the United States wants at this point from the Security Council is a vaguely worded resolution, which it can use as some sort of veneer to impose, along with the EU, specifically Britain, its own sanctions, and I'm not sure exactly what shape those will take. But they can range from the mild forms of sanctions, such as diplomatic sanctions or diplomatic criticisms, to something much more severe.
I guess everybody kind of agrees that militarily it's not really feasible to attack Iran or to do a large-scale operation the same as they did in Iraq. What are the military options? I guess if I want to kind of quote Senator McCain, a Republican hopeful for 2008 presidential election, he just noted in a security conference in Munich a few days ago, and he said the worst option than attacking Iran is a nuclear Iran, which means there's kind of agreement between the hawkish part of the administration and Democrats in that matter. We have heard of Senator Clinton as well kind of criticizing the administration for not being active in dealing with Iran in this regard. And so is there any military option available to U.S. and allies?
Well, I'm not a military specialist, but I suppose that rattling the saber at Iran is, as politically for any American politician, is a no-brainer. That's going to automatically score them points, and it's never going to cost them any points. So I'm not going to take what McCain says at face value. However, especially if any of these people have presidential hopes in the future. However, military options short of a full-scale invasion also exist. I'm sure they've been modeling and role-playing these various games for a long time now. There are suggestions out there about stirring up separatists and just simply attacking Iran's nuclear facilities and letting the chips fall where they may. There may be an embargo on the shipping to and from Iran from its southern coastline along the Persian Gulf. There may be even direct attacks on the leaders of the government. All of these options potentially exist, which are short of full-scale invasion. Now, how effective they're going to be, I can't address that. I doubt that they will be very effective, and I doubt that the people who are espousing such views have an end game in mind. They didn't have an end game in mind in Iraq. The planning for Iraq seemed to go as far as toppling Saddam Hussein, and from there on, nobody quite knew what they were going to do. So I'm not sure if they have any plans about what happens the day after they bomb Iran either. However, I don't know if that will necessarily stop them from doing so.
All right, let's take another short break, and I would invite the audience, if they have any question or comments they want to call in. It's 503-231-8187. I don't know, Cyrus, can you stay longer for answering questions?
Yes.
All right.